It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In just a bit, we'll look at some new technology that could allow cancer patients to keep their hair during chemotherapy. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, we take a look at U.S.-Russia relations. President Obama announced today that he's canceling a planned meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The decision comes amid tension over NSA leaker Edward Snowden.
Is this just a diplomatic snub, or is there more to it? And as we head down the rocky road to the 2014 Winter Olympics in Russia, what can we expect from both countries? Joining us now is Pierre Atlas. He's professor of political science and director of global studies at Marion University. Pierre, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how rocky are U.S.-Russian relations right about now?
Well, they're definitely in a rough patch. There are a lot of issues that are on the table, causing a lot of controversy. And the Snowden issue is just the latest. And you know, I think the real reason for why the summit was canceled.
And that the Snowden reason, Edward Snowden, who revealed all those leaks about the NSA in Russia getting temporary sanctuary, was that, do you think, and I know you're not inside the mind of Vladimir Putin, but was that a calculated snub of the United States?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent, I would say it was. The Russians would say that technically it's a government ministry decision, not Putin's himself, to grant the temporary asylum. But I think clearly the Russians granted it with his approval and probably with his intent. So I think part of it was definitely a snub. To be honest, though, if you think about what other options did Russia have with Snowden, they couldn't let him stay indefinitely in the airport forever. Something had to be done. Had they released him and let him go to a Latin American country where he would get asylum, where his passport has already been withdrawn, he technically is not allowed to fly on an airplane. Had they let him go, that would have been probably even a bigger insult to the United States. And then there is a sense of Russian national pride, the fact that there is no extradition treaty with the United States, and this idea that Russia wants to be treated as an equal, and basically doing the bidding for the United States from the Russian perspective, and just letting him go back to the United States when there is no extradition treaty, that might have been seen as Russia giving in. So I think it was probably, overall, the different choices that Russia had, this was probably the option that was the easiest for them to do, which was to grant Snowden a temporary asylum.
You know, diplomats, state departments, that sort of thing, put so much time into careful negotiations and planning, and it seems like every so often you get this weird, fluky event that throws things all akimbo. Is this just the story of diplomacy?
That certainly can be the case. I think, again, here, Snowden was the ultimate reason for canceling, or as the Obama administration said, they're postponing the summit. But really, if you think about it, you want to hold a summit, a major diplomatic summit, when you think you can accomplish something. And there really wasn't any likelihood of anything positive coming out of this summit. There are so many issues that the U.S. and Russia are at loggerheads over, whether it's Syria or arms control or Russia's crackdown on internal dissent and other human rights issues, trade, this new anti-gay law. I mean, a lot of different issues that are really kind of the U.S. and Russia are going nowhere. The summit probably would not have accomplished anything anyway. So in some ways, Snowden, which was seen as a slap in the face to the U.S., was sort of an ideal opportunity, in my opinion, to go ahead and cancel the summit rather than go forward. Even without Snowden, nothing positive probably would have come out of this. And then it would have just been a photo op that would have been kind of empty.
Well, let's dig into a couple of those issues you just mentioned and start with Syria. Where are the U.S. and Russia when it comes to being anywhere near an agreement on what to do about Syria?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Okay.
Russia is fully supporting the Assad regime. If anything, they've doubled down on it. It's really the last foothold that Russia has in the Arab world. They're supporting the regime for lots of reasons, affinity with the Christian minority, the fact that they have access to a military base, they're selling weapons, they're getting cash. There's a sense, again, of national pride that this is sort of like their last foothold in the Arab world. There are a lot of reasons for that. They also want to oppose the United States. They have very much stronger relations with Iran, obviously, than we do, and Iran and Russia are on the same side. In supporting their regime, there's a lot of factors there that motivate them to take the position that they are in, and there really isn't a lot of motivation for them to change their position. I think, you know, they could be convinced to do so, but that's a far way. That's a long way off.
Well, President Obama was on with Jay Leno last night. He said, quote, there are times when Russia slips back into Cold War thinking and a Cold War mentality. Is that fair? Is there a Cold War mentality within Russia?
You know, I saw that. I think that's true to a certain extent. In some ways, my sense of Putin isn't so much that he wants to return to the Soviet Union. I think he kind of wants to return to the Tsarist era of Russia, where Russia again had a major influence in the world. He isn't, you know, interested in going back to totalitarianism, but he certainly is cracking down on dissent and wants Russia to have a major position in the world, and doesn't like the idea that the United States is sort of seeing them as less relevant. I mean, we're focusing on China. We're pivoting to the Pacific. I think Russia is sort of saying, hey, what about us? We want to still count. And there's a tremendous amount of suspicion towards the United States in Europe. I mean, with the missile defense and a lot of other issues, Syria and elsewhere. So I think it's easy to say it's Cold War, and in some ways that certainly looks that way. But it's not. I wouldn't take it to the full extent and say that, you know, they want to return to the bad old days of the Soviet Union, for example.
What does this look like from inside Russia? Are people weighing a trade-off maybe between some of the crackdowns you mentioned and having Russia have a place in the sun on the international stage?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Some Russian human rights activists have been saying that they actually thought that granting Snowden asylum was a good thing, that was actually consistent with sort of international human rights understandings of asylum. But then at the same time, they were saying, but clearly the Russian government would not treat their own whistleblowers that way. I was looking at some sources here. Human rights activists and organizations in Russia were saying that they just wish that Russia would do this, would be consistent, you know, in that sense. But again, I think there is a sense of national pride that Russia is a major player, and that they're being taken seriously. On the other hand, the other hand, they are cracking down even harder on their own internal dissent, and that certainly is not popular with a lot of Russians.
Do people feel that sense of history in Russia? You know, we had Peter the Great, we beat Napoleon, we beat Hitler. We are a major power, and the world should treat us that way.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And not only that, economically, people felt that they were, you know, they're looking back. A lot of people looking back to the Soviet Union with nostalgia, which is kind of ironic because they seem to have forgotten about the bread lines and things like that. And obviously the loss of freedom. But the idea of, you know, high unemployment, of people not being able to put food on the table, of old people being, you know, basically, you know, eating dog food and things like this. That also sort of reminds them of, hey, how far we've come down. And Putin is I think taking advantage of that to restore a sense of nostalgia, taking advantage of that sense of nostalgia. Also, I think it is important that, you know, just like, you know, President Obama and American leaders have domestic audiences, Putin has a domestic audience too. So not only everything he's doing is also to bolster his own credibility and legitimacy within the country. And picking on the United States for a lot of people is an easy target.
2014 Winter Olympics are coming up in Russia. Is that going to be a political football or discus? No, wait, that's a Summer Olympic one. But is it going to be a political beast there?
It could be. I mean, I know there's some people here who are saying that, you know, the United States should, for example, boycott that. I think I heard Lindsey Graham say that. I think that's not going to happen, and that would certainly be a mistake. One of the more interesting things that will happen, I mean, obviously every country that hosts the Olympics, it's a very big deal for that country. This will be a very big deal for Russia. They're going to make a lot out of it. One of the interesting things is this new conflict over the anti-gay law that makes what they call homosexual propaganda illegal, which is basically any kind of advocacy of gay rights is a crime. And it'll be interesting to see how that impacts on the Olympics. And there was an interesting article today in the New York Times about that not only will Russia be cracking down on this, but so will the International Olympic Committee, which prohibits any athletes from making any kind of political statement. So if you have an Olympian who wants to show gay pride or something, he or she might actually be sent home by the IOC or perhaps arrested by the Russians. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting thing to watch.
Moving forward, as long as we're talking about President Obama and President Putin, are things going to get any better, or is there going to have to be a change of leadership before things might warm up?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think it's safe to say that President Putin will be in power long after President Obama leaves office. And then the question is, even if whoever replaces Obama, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, will they have a better shot at it? I mean, we could sort of do a counterfactual. Had Mitt Romney won the election in 2012, do you think we would be having a better relationship with Russia? I don't think we would. In fact, if anything, Romney had signaled that he would take a stronger, harsher stance against Russia, and I don't think that would have necessarily made a better relationship. You know, presidents in their second term start thinking about legacy, and one of the easiest ways to build your legacy is in foreign policy. That a lot of presidents have done that, and it could very well be that Obama will try and take an opportunity out of this. I mean, things are pretty low. You know, both the United States and Russia want to have better relations with each other. It's in their interest to do so. And perhaps they can work something out. Maybe there'll be an opportunity or a silver lining out of this, the postponed summit. Maybe they can get something out of it.
Pierre, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Pierre Atlas. He's professor of political science and director of global studies at Marion University.
Coming up next, we'll look at a new technology that could allow cancer patients to keep their hair during chemotherapy. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
When it comes to treating cancer, one of the first questions on a person's mind is often, will I lose my hair?
Doctors say their patients aren't concerned about hair loss out of vanity. They say it's an outward symbol of an illness they wish to keep private sometimes.
But new experimental technologies called cold caps might make it easier for cancer patients to keep their hair during chemotherapy. Here to talk about it is Dr. Hope Rugo. She's a clinical professor in health sciences and director of the Breast Oncology Clinical Trials Program at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Rugo, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, give us a little overview. What are cold caps? How do they work?
So cold caps, actually, this is the idea of making the scalp and the blood vessels that feed the hair follicles that make the hair cool. So you make it cool, blood flow decreases, metabolism decreases. And the idea is two things. One is you deliver less chemotherapy to the hair follicles so that you try and prevent the damage to those cells. And the second thing is you reduce the metabolism of those cells so that they don't maybe need as much blood in order to stay alive. And by doing both of those things, you can potentially prevent the chemotherapy damage to hair follicles, which is an unintended and not valuable side effect from chemotherapy.
And based on your research so far, how much hair is often saved on account of cold caps?
Well, cold caps have been around for a very long time. As I just explained, it's a kind of a simple idea, the idea that you would make it cool, you get less blood flow. We all know that, and you would reduce metabolism. The ability to cool the scalp has changed a lot over three decades, from putting ice around the head, where it didn't work very well, to using caps that didn't maintain their temperature. But with new materials, the caps are much better, and there's two main ways to cool the scalp. And with these mechanisms of cooling the scalp, patients maintain more than 50% of their hair, the majority of patients. Some of it has to do with the type of chemotherapy. Some has to do with your own hair itself, how much baseline hair loss you have. And then lastly, of course, the way the caps are used, you know, how well they're fitted to the scalp. We don't use scalp cooling for some kinds of cancers that are everywhere at once, like a leukemia, for example, that's in the blood, because possibly that might do some downside in terms of the effect of the chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Did you say 15% of hair or 50%?
50. Yeah. And, you know, of course, for many of the chemotherapy regimens we give to women with breast cancer, where my work is focused, the patients will keep more than 75% of their hair. So they have thinning. Hair still falls out, but the majority of the hair is present. And what that ends up resulting in is either they don't have to wear any head covering, or if they had developed an area of thinning and need to wear a head covering at some point to feel comfortable, their hair will fill in much more quickly than if they lose their entire head of hair.
What's the level of discomfort that a patient might feel, though, as they're wearing these cold caps?
Well, cold caps, you know, they're cold.
Yeah.
And we go down to 3 to 5 degrees or so, and centigrade, most people tolerate it pretty well. Some people are very sensitive to the cold effect, and what we found is that it is the cooling process that is most uncomfortable. It's kind of like having a brain freeze from eating ice cream on a hot day. So if people stay warm and drink some warm tea, and sometimes they'll take a Tylenol or Motrin Advil-type medication, they generally tolerate the cooling process well, and then to maintain the cold temperature seems to be much better tolerated.
Hmm. Well, you had mentioned that cold caps have been around for a while, but here in the U.S., it still hasn't been approved by the FDA. I'm curious what is still under consideration before it would be approved for widespread use.
Well, as I mentioned, there's two main ways that cooling can be accomplished. And then there's a lot of other companies now that are very interested in making cooling products. One is a cold cap system that is put in a freezer the day before you get the chemotherapy, and you put the cap on out of the freezer, and then you have to change it every 20 minutes as it warms up. So that's one type of scalp cooling. The second type of scalp cooling is a machine that actually has a coolant that circulates through the cap so that you put the cap on and you basically just sit there. The advantage of that second system is that it alleviates the patient of any responsibility or cost in terms of renting or purchasing the cold caps. There are obviously, if these are used more routinely, there will be some cost just to having the machine in that facility and placing the cap on. But you don't need a freezer, and the coolant circulates through the cap and maintains a cold temperature. When you use cooling caps, you put them on so that the scalp is already cool before you start the chemo, so about a half an hour beforehand. And then you have to keep the cap on for at least 2 hours afterwards while the sort of heavy doses of chemotherapy are cleared from your system. So that's how they work. Now, the question is, why aren't they approved? 30 years ago, 25 years ago, there was concern that maybe if you prevented the chemotherapy in its highest doses from reaching the scalp, that you might get scalp metastases, or cancer might come back on the scalp. Mm. There was also concern that it didn't work well. We've now shown in large data sets that the risk of having scalp metastases is very low in breast cancer and not higher with scalp cooling. So we went to the FDA and we said, with this second system made by a company called Dignitana, where patients come in and put the cap on during their chemo through this circulating coolant from a machine, what would we need to do to get FDA approval? The first thing they wanted us to do was a 20-patient pilot, although this has been used in thousands of patients worldwide, not in the U.S. So we did a 20-patient pilot with Wake Forest University, our partners in developing this protocol, and showed that it was very effective and well-tolerated in the majority of women. So now we're opening and have had an FDA clearance to open a larger trial in 100 women where hopefully those results will be able to be presented to the FDA for approval of this device. And what that means is then patients can use it because centers might purchase it, and potentially in the future we will be able to get a small amount of insurance reimbursement as well.
What's the timeline on that? What do you foresee in terms of getting approval?
Well, we hope that the trial will enter its first patient this month, and there should be no problem with that. We have 5 centers across the United States that will be participating, and of course there's been great interest from other sites as well. And then I expect that we'll enroll all of the patients within a year, at the most a year and a half. And then we'll have the data fairly quickly afterwards, because our endpoint is just the amount of hair a patient has when they come in for their first visit after the end of chemotherapy. So we should be able to present to the FDA within less than 2 years. Everything always ends up being a little bit slower when you're working with federal agencies, but we have high hopes that that's what will happen.
Great. Well, in the meantime, in our last few seconds, what options do people have right now while it's still in the trial phase in just a few seconds?
They have the option of renting on their own the Penguin cold caps. And if you search online, you can find the contact information and rent them directly. The man who runs that company, Frank Frond, is extremely helpful for patients, and it works very well. And just as I know we're done with this, but I wanted to mention that this is only possible through the vision of the director of our breast group, Laura Esserman, and through tremendous philanthropic support from the Tauber Foundation.
Well, Dr. Rugo, thank you so much.
Thank you for highlighting this project.
Dr. Hope Rugo is clinical professor in health sciences and director of the Breast Oncology Clinical Trials Program at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, how ADA medication affects children in the classroom. That's tomorrow on Central Time. And coming up after the news, we'll talk to you about your best and worst vacation experiences. And you could start calling in now, actually, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Verrett.
I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert. August is vacation season for many of us, and lots of us are trying to capture the last weeks of summer and have some fun. Well, we want to hear from you. We're taking your calls for the rest of the hour on vacations. What's the best vacation you've been on? What made it so amazing?
Or what's the worst vacation you've ever taken? What went wrong? Why was it so bad?
Well, maybe you have a dream vacation that you have yet to go on. You can tell us about all those things at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org.
And while you're calling in, it's time for Wisconsin Life. In southeast Wisconsin, there's a secluded, heavily wooded private area where people like to get away, relax with friends, share food and drinks, just like any other campground, except one thing. Just about everybody is naked. WPR's Maureen McCollum visited the Naturist Clothing Optional Resort. The names have been changed to protect the clothesless.
Sarah and Chris's campsite would be coveted by many people. A canopy of trees covers a modern trailer that resembles a log cabin. Comfy chairs surround a large fire pit, and they have a stainless steel, fully stocked outdoor kitchen. It's hot and muggy, and a huge fan is on full blast, cooling them down. Chris and Sarah live in Chicago during the week because of their jobs. As he chops onions for tonight's dinner, Chris says they consider this home and come every weekend.
Yeah, we can hide away, away from all the hassle and bustle.
While it's paradise for some, not everyone would be comfortable here because it's clothing optional, heavy emphasis on the optional. Chris and Sarah were drawn to this location because of its natural beauty. The fact that the camp is for naturists was an added bonus. The couple first met at a nudist camp on the East Coast. At the time, Chris was a seasoned vet, but it was Sarah's first time.
I was really nervous. I was scared. I asked my friend, where am I supposed to look? You know, like, it's, you know, unusual. But then you realize before too long that everybody's used to it. So, you know, nobody's looking at anything. They're just going about their business. And we played tennis and played volleyball. And
Sarah says she, like most people, was raised to be uncomfortable with nudity, but she's gotten over it.
It breaks down all the barriers between people. I mean, even if you go to a swimming pool and people have bathing suits, they kind of try to impress each other with their bathing suits. And here, there's none of that. Everybody's on the same level. It's unique, and, you know, when you see people that are just being so comfortable with themselves, you know, you don't have to feel self-conscious.
As for Chris, he likes to avoid the mosquitoes and prefers being naked in the winter around their giant campfire.
It's unrestricted, really. It's freedom, you know, feeling one with nature.
Sarah prefers the summertime.
Well, first of all, if you ever go swimming without a bathing suit, you will understand how much more comfortable it is without a bathing suit on.
The only place at the campsite that requires nudity is the pool. That prevents visiting gawkers from staring.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hey.
A group of Chris and Sarah's friends show up for dinner, fully clothed. Chris pokes fun at them for wearing clothing.
You're holding back. You're like, come on, come on.
Get rid of it. We're all born naked. We're going to die naked. You know?
No, I'm going with a tuxedo.
Oh, you are, yeah.
Around other parts of the campsite, people drive around in golf carts, naked, share a candlelit dinner, naked, and sit in a circle drinking beer, naked, and of course, lounge poolside, naked, because they all know what happens at the nudist camp in southeast Wisconsin stays at the nudist camp.
Thanks, Maureen.
Okay. Now to your calls on vacations. What's the best vacation you've ever taken or the most memorable? What made it so good?
Do you have a favorite vacation memory or a vacation you want to go on and you hope will be memorable? Or tell us about a trip that didn't go so well. It's Vacation Talk, and we're talking to you at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, we have Victor in West Allis ready to tell us about his one of his vacations. Hi, Victor.
Here's what happened. About 2005, Marion and I, the wife, went to Berlin, Germany, and we were just touring around. They had these outdoor toilets. It cost about 50 cents. So we both decided to go in to double up, you know, because the lines were pretty long. So she went first, and then, you know, I turned around, and then I went. And then I was pushing these buttons somewhere in Braille, and I pressed it, and all I wanted was this countdown. The countdown was that within 20 seconds, the door opens up, and then all the toilet paper dispensers cover up, and then there's like a little shower near the dryer. So I got up real quick, turned around, and unfortunately, I mooned everybody. What's even more amazing, I have my Wisconsin sweatshirt on.
But now they all know where you're from.
And they still tell the legend of the Wisconsinite who mooned them in Berlin.
Right. Right. And that was just funny and embarrassing. Marlene was laughing, so I think she peed in her pants again.
Well, there's an attempt at frugality gone wrong, I suppose. But and overall, that was a great trip?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We love my wife and I. The wife, Marlene, loves Berlin. I love Munich. Munich is a much younger little city, and it's a lot more fun.
Have you been back without toilet mishaps since then?
No, I tell you, I miss my 747s and miss my bigger airplanes, I'll be honest with you. Mm. And now I feel like a sardine can.
All right. Well, Victor, thank you so much for sharing that story, and go one at a time next time, I think, is probably the lesson there for all travelers.
Oh, yeah.
We'll go back to the phones now. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 with your favorite vacation memory. Maybe an annual vacation you take with your family. We've got Brianna in Rice Lake. Brianna, welcome
Brenna.
To the show.
Yeah.
Hi, actually my name is Rana.
Rana, hi.
And I am calling from Rice Lake. We quite often just go to a lake not too far from us. Called Bass Lake, and we fish. And one year, when the older kids were younger, my husband didn't want me to have to wash a lot of pots and pans after our evening meal, after around the campfire. So he said, we're going to just stick this can of beans right on the edge of the fire here.
Uh-oh.
And when the beans when the can bulges a little, it's done. So I thought, okay, I'll keep my eye on that. And they went fishing down over the end of the embankment, and pretty soon he heard boom, 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 boom. He thought someone was shooting at us, came running up the embankment, and there were beans everywhere. Beans burned holes in the tent, beans all over me, beans everywhere. And to this day, I cannot look at pork and beans without thinking of that story. And every time we eat them anywhere, my kids have to retell that story because it is just one we will never, ever forget.
Well, that is the definition of looking back on something and laughing, I hope.
Oh, it's just hysterical. The time I was irate. But now it's just really funny. And we still have the tent that has the bean holes burned in it to prove it.
Do you still use the tent?
We just kept it for momentous sake. Because they're like quarter-size holes in some places.
Well, you know, you can go stargazing on a clear night.
Yeah.
Observe the eclipse.
Yeah.
Very good. Anyway, it was just kind of a funny story. So thank you.
Rana, thank you so much. All right. So far, some vacation fiascos. You can call with your fiasco or a cherished memory at 800-642-1234.
And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We've got Dave in Richland Center next. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What's your story?
How are you this afternoon? What's my story? Mine's not so humorous. It's just a favorite spot. We went a few years ago, went to Canada, and was visiting a provincial park out in the western part, and we went to one called Banff. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I just loved that place because it's not really a big village, but it kind of sits down in a valley, and it's got like an old world charm. So they got the streets and the facades of the building and stuff kind of would remind you of a place, you know, maybe in a small village in Switzerland or somewhere like that. And it was just so neat to be in that kind of a setting. You know, and then yet not that far from, you know, where your home country is without traveling, you know, overseas to see those sites.
Are you inspired now to find similar locales to?
Definitely, because it's just that old world look, you know, and, you know, like I said, the narrow streets and the buildings and, you know, just the location you could imagine yourself in one, you know, in one of those countries.
Nice. Well, thanks for telling us about that, Dave.
All right. Thanks, Dave, for the story. Now we'll go to Tim with us from Mount Horeb. Tim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Now, what's your vacation story, Tim?
I was studying abroad in Australia, and we took a week-long trip to New Zealand over our spring break. Mm-hmm. And it was the best part about it for me, we hitchhiked everywhere. And so as we were hitchhiking, we came across all these really cool people who were driving us places, and we never quite knew where we were going to end up. And we ended up on this mountain camping for one night, and it was just, we were surrounded by mountains and there were no lights anywhere, and it was just absolutely gorgeous.
And have you seen Lord of the Rings since then, Tim?
You know, I have, and there's a lot of tours around offering tours of places that were filmed in the movie Lord of the Rings.
And when you were watching, did you think, oh, yeah, I was there?
Yeah, in one of the movies where all the horses ride over the hill to save the day, we hiked through that valley. It was incredible.
No kidding.
So, Tim, you weren't concerned at all about safety? Mm. I mean,
hitchhiking,
you know,
yeah.
Well, actually, we were planning on renting a car. And the woman who was running the rental car place was this American in her late 20s, and she had moved there to New Zealand after going on vacation, and she said she hitchhiked every day to and from work.
Wow.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, it's very common there, and we had a great time doing it.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tim. Glad you had that great vacation. Thanks for sharing your story. Now, how about you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We're looking for your best vacation ever, one you've actually done or one you're hoping to do, a cherished vacation memory or a fiasco that hopefully you laughed about later. 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're taking calls on vacations. What's your favorite vacation memory? What trip would you like to go on again if you could?
Or what's your vacation fiasco story, the one you still hopefully look back on and laugh? Call
those
it
are sometimes 800- those the are- best stories.
Yeah, when you're far enough removed from them, definitely. You can give a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's talk next to Lawrence in Marathon.
Hello.
Hi. What's your story?
In 95, my wife and I were invited to a 4th of July celebration at a very rustic and isolated campsite on Beaver Lake in Arkansas. We had just been married and taken leaves of absence from our work. Well, after everyone left, after the 4th, we stayed on for 3 weeks. And every morning we would get up and say, well, do you think we need to get dressed today? And the answer was no for about 3 weeks. We would go down to the water and swim nude and just lived nude in the woods. It was the most relaxing and the greatest vacation I ever had.
Wow. So you related a little bit to our story there from Maureen McCollum.
That's right.
On Wisconsin
That's right.
Life.
And
I'm not willing to go to the nudist Buddhist camp with my friends.
Gotcha. Just you two, huh?
J- just the two of us in private. It was very relaxing.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for sharing that story, Lawrence. I appreciate it. And we go now to Jessica and Wapan. Jessica, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. My story is more of a fiasco. When I was like 18 years old, this was about 10 years ago, me and a friend from college, she invited me to a trip to the Bahamas. And we're both really short, so people thought we were like 12 years old. And needless to say, we're at the Bahamas, and I'm really want to believe pretty much anything. And this man, from a local man, came up to me and said his woman was in labor, having a baby, and they needed money or else something bad would happen. So I gave him all my spending money, and he turned around and ran the other way. And my friend never lets me forget it.
Well, you obviously made it back. Did that ruin the rest of the vacation for you?
No, we still had a pretty good time in paradise, but I never get to forget giving my money away.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad it still worked out and you had fun afterward, Jessica, and thanks for sharing your story.
Well, let's talk next to Joanne in Black River Falls. Hi, Joanne.
Hello. I want to relate the best vacation ever. My family with two children and another family with two children, we rented a houseboat on the Chena Lakes, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and it was fabulous. I think if we were able to dial the weather, we couldn't have done better. It was glorious, and we participated in everything and anything that was available. We had our groceries brought out to us by the group, you know, where we had rented. We'd place our order like on the morning that we left their place, and they'd come out and find us and deliver our groceries.
Well, that's great.
Like, you know, about Tuesday. And everything about that outing was fantastic. My children now are 47 and 49, and that is absolutely the epitome of the best.
Wonderful. Well, you know, I was just out by the Mississippi River and seeing people on houseboats, and I had that one worry that you touched on. Looks great. What if the weather goes bad? But you got pretty lucky, huh?
Oh, we were. It was a spectacular success. Yes, it was great. And the other family had two children that were like, our children were maybe, say, 6th and 8th grade, and theirs were 9th and 10th.
Perfect.
And everybody had a grand time. It was fabulous. And if only things like that could be repeated. But...
Well, thanks, Joanne. And Joanne also gives a good example of how we can take advantage of all the wonderful things to do in our own backyard.
That's right.
We don't have to travel all the way far away if we don't wish to. We've got Rachel in Milwaukee next. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good afternoon. My family's favorite summer activity in terms of vacation and time together is to travel up to northern Wisconsin and to the UP and do whitewater rafting as a family. My husband is somebody who's from Nepal, and he's been a rafter in his home country his whole life and relocated to Wisconsin to be here with family, myself, and our children. And it's been a thrill to be able to drive just 3 to 4 hours outside of Milwaukee and hop on a raft and get on a nice Class 3 rapid right in Wisconsin.
I got to wonder, Rachel, your husband's from Nepal, land obviously of mountains, and I imagine some pretty serious rapids, given the altitude changes there. Does he look around northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, and say, you call these rapids?
You know, on the Menominee River, right up around Norway, Michigan, which is right over the border, there is a beautiful Class 3+ rapid. It's a dam release river, and so the water levels are managed by the dam, and it's as much of a thrill as the Class 3s any place else in the world that he's been on a raft. So the rapids are not continuous rapids as they are coming down from Tibet and into Nepal, but you also don't have to travel halfway around the world. Just jump in your car and drive up north. So.
That's great. We'll have fun if you're going out again this year, Rachel, and thanks for calling. A couple lines have opened up, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Still might be time to get you in there.
Let's go next to Mary and Nina. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My best vacation was in South Africa. I went with some family members. One of them was a foreign exchange student there. And we went to South Africa and Zimbabwe. And when we took a small plane back to Johannesburg from Zimbabwe, we had to stop at a little town in between, and they had to chase the elephants off the runway.
Wow.
For us to land.
Wow.
We also saw Victoria Falls, which is, you know, just a tremendous sight. It was 1981. Apartheid was still going on, so that was kind of a strange thing. We had to be careful to be in the European areas as opposed to the non-European areas. Mm-hmm. Politically, it was a pretty interesting place to be.
Do you think you'd like to go back?
Oh, I'd definitely like to go back. It was very exciting, and there's not too many places. You could just see the animals, you know, elephants and lions and whatever, just running around, you know.
All right.
When they chased them off the airport, the runway.
I would like to see that.
Yeah, no,
that's something I want to see.
Mary, thank you so much. Yeah, we've got an email from Alan. He writes, my favorite destination would have to be the Smoky Mountains and the surrounding areas. This place is best traveled through on a motorcycle. There's a stretch known as the Tail of the Dragon. I'd like to hear more about that. He says, I've been there 3 times. Hope to go again this weekend. Getting there is usually easy, but the rain usually gets me on my way home. A bummer on that long motorcycle trip.
Yeah. Have you done a road trip?
On a motorcycle? No, I've
no,
never.
I know.
road trips. No, you know, I'll say my favorite vacation spot is Lake Superior. I mean, I'm learning to love the Mississippi a lot lately, but childhood memories up in the UP, some trips up to Madeline Island now, Bayfield, family, a lot of memories. It's me as a kid and now my kids up there. One of my all-time favorites.
And coming up from Madison to Superior is a road trip in itself.
Definitely.
Sometimes.
Definitely.
Yeah. Let's try to squeeze in Tom in Menominee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you a quick story about my parents and I when we were small kids. We were taking a trip to New York City, and we were going to go visit the Empire State Building. We had never been there before, and so we were all kind of excited. We found a man that was begging on the side of the street, and he was in pretty sad shape. My mother's an RN, and all of a sudden, she scooted us away from the man, and we thought there was something wrong. And all of a sudden, she, instead of going into the Empire State Building, she took us over to a drugstore, and we were buying bandages, we were buying every sort of antibiotic available, and we went over and took care of this man. He had some sore feet and some sore hands, and it was just a really eye-opening experience that we were able to really help this guy out, and not just, you know, begging for money. We were, you know, doing something more.
Tom,
I thought it was kind of a neat experience.
That's a great story, Tom. Thanks for sharing that.
And Cynthia, I know you, just want to mention, had the vacation of a lifetime a couple years ago. Antarctica.
That was a summer vacation in December. That's right. Well, thanks.
Maybe we'll talk more about that sometime. I know you've talked about it on the air before.
Well, thanks to everyone who called in during this segment. And you can continue the discussion on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're going to talk about childhood obesity coming up in just a few minutes. A new study showing some improvements. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.